What is up, everybody? Dr. Joe Armstrong here, and I am super excited to tell you that we have a sponsor, and that sponsor is Medgene. It's a new day in animal healthcare, and Medgene is wide awake. Medgene is the first USDA-licensed producer of prescription platform vaccines. Medgene's prescription platform vaccines help veterinarians in the swine, cattle, deer, and rabbit industries respond faster and more efficiently. Learn more about Medgene's prescription platform vaccines at MedgeneLabs.com. That's MedgeneLabs.com. Or better yet, follow Medgene on Facebook and LinkedIn. Medgene, it's a new day in animal healthcare. What is up, everybody? Dr. Joe Armstrong. Today is 6/21/24 at approximately 3 p.m. To start, same message as we always seem to bring up and we need to continue to bring up is that milk is safe, meat is safe, continue to drink milk, continue to eat meat. I continue to do so myself, and I continue to give milk and meat to my kids. All right, let's get an update on where we are overall as a country. What states are officially on the board when it comes to H5N1 in cattle? Officially on the board as of today, Texas, New Mexico, Kansas, Colorado, Wyoming, Idaho, South Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa, Michigan, Ohio, and North Carolina. As of today, we have 6 dairy herds officially positive in Minnesota. Those counties include Sibley, Benton, Lincoln, Kandy, Ojai, and Morrison. That's 5, but there are 2 in Benton County. Last week, we talked at length about all sorts of stuff. And at the end of that episode, I promised that we would get to some epidemiological reports from USDA that I hadn't had time to go through yet. They're a little dense, but I think they have some key takeaways. We're going to pore over them a little bit and make sure that the data from the epi reports and what we're seeing in the that is reported matches with what they're saying the key takeaways are. I will make sure the links to these documents are available in the show notes so you can read them for yourself. We don't have time to go over it all. I mean, that would be an hour-long episode, and no one wants to hear me talk for that long. So we're going to go through some of the big things that I noticed, and we're going to focus a little more on one of the documents rather than the other. The one document is about Michigan dairy herds and poultry flocks, and that summarizes some of the epidemiological data that they have. And I think it would be a little redundant to do both documents because the Michigan document has a lot of the same information as in the other document that we're going to focus on more. In general, the summary in the Michigan document basically tells us that there are 4 big risk factors that they found and potential transmission pathways that they're looking at based on what they found in Michigan. So they're looking at animal movement, visitors, shared vehicles and equipment, shared workers, and local wildlife. And in that local wildlife category, we're including what they're calling peri-domestic species. So think barn cats when you hear peri-domestic. In this Michigan document, there are 15 dairy farms impacted by the virus that they included in the study and 8 poultry flocks. So that is our sample size, 15 dairy farms, 8 poultry flocks. All right, let's get into what they said and some of the summary of this. So when we talk about shared personnel, they're saying that 20% of affected dairies employees also work on other dairy premises. 20%, that's pretty high and not all that surprising, but it's high. It's good to have a number to put to it. In addition to that, 31% of the dairies have employees who own livestock or poultry at their personal residence. Again, good to know, not super surprising again, but it's good information to know. And this is in Michigan, remember. It's not all that different from Minnesota. Is it different in terms of operation and just style of operation and agriculture? A little bit, but it's not so drastically different. Here's a big one. 62% of affected dairy premises used shared vehicles to transport cattle, with only 12% of the premises cleaning vehicles before use. That's a little scary, right? We preach a lot about having clean trailers and clean transport methods for cattle. So that's concerning. And then we get to frequent visitors, okay, on and off the premise. 100% of the affected dairies have regular visits by a veterinarian, nutritionist, feed consultant, and or contract hauler. Contract hauler being someone who moves cattle or moves manure or something else like that. And the majority of those visitors have direct contact with cattle. 40% of the affected dairy premises have regular visits for dead stock removal. And not surprising, considering where we are with rendering, 53% of the affected dairies utilize the same dead stock removal company, and 40% had animals removed from the premises by that company within 30 days prior to clinical onset. So important to note, none of these things are definitively a cause of transmission. They are potential, and they have shown shared commonalities or risk factors between these affected farms. So it's really just data that tells us where to look. It doesn't tell us exactly what's going on. I think the best example of that is milk hauling, right? The way milk hauling works, it's very, very geographically connected. And we know that probably this virus is spreading in a local geographic area. So if we're talking about 15 dairies that are close together, it's also quite likely that they would have common co-ops just because of geography. So just because they have that commonality doesn't mean that the milk haulers are part of the problem. It's just a commonality that happens to be coincidence, or it maybe it is part of the problem. We don't know. It just tells us where to look. So in this situation, this report, 93% of affected dairy premises are part of the same milk co-op with at least one other affected dairy premise within the state. Only one of the affected dairy herds is part of a milk co-op that none of the other 14 affected dairy herds belong to. So again, it makes sense that of these 14 herds, most of them have a common co-op with at least one of the other herds. It's just because that's the way hauling milk works. So it's a commonality. Does it point to it and say, well, they all share this, so therefore it must be a problem? No. It tells us where to look at potential sources of transmission. Am I surprised by any of the data in this document? There's nothing here that I can find that's surprising. For the most part, it put numbers to things that we suspected, and it pretty much just described how the dairy industry works. That's what I'm looking at in this document. It's a good summary to know things that we kind of know, I would say, in quotes, in the dairy industry. Like, we know that employees are shared between premises, but it's nice to have numbers put to it, absolutely. So when I take a quick look at the table of all the things they asked in this survey to get a picture of what's going on from an epidemiological standpoint, there's a couple things that stand out. And one of the things is that when we look at cattle movement, which we've said cattle movement is definitely a problem, and we know it's a problem, but in this document, they're asking about cattle added to the operation in the 30 days prior to clinical signs. And of the 15 affected dairy farms, only 6 reported, yes, we added any cattle of any class. And we've talked a lot about lactating dairy cows being a big factor in this. And only 3 out of the 15 affected farms reported adding lactating dairy cows to the operation in the 30 days prior to clinical signs. So what does that tell us? It tells us that there's way more to this picture of how this is moving around. It's not just cattle movements. That's something we've known for quite a while, and it's something that they talk about in this document. But it is really nice to have numbers to put to it. Small sample size, they talk about that as well. You know, we need more affected farms to study so we can get more information about where to look next. But it's nice to have some numbers to say, hey, where did it come from if it wasn't from cattle movements? Not surprisingly, and something we also knew, all 15 farms reported that wild birds, wild animals, and rodents have access to cattle feed. That is an incredibly hard thing to stop on a dairy farm, and the way we manage feed now, it's almost impossible. All right, another interesting thing to look at is, what are we doing with waste milk? Of the 15 farms, there are 5 farms that feed waste milk to calves on the dairy. 2 of them pasteurize, 3 of them do not. When we look at waste milk, where is it going? Where does it get put? Well, in this study, waste milk is disposed of in lagoons on 11 of the 15 farms. On 10 of the farms, they are not treating the waste milk at all before it goes in the lagoon. One of the farms out of the 10 that puts waste milk in lagoons says that they are pasteurizing some of it, but not all of it. So we have raw waste milk going into lagoons, and that's a big risk factor, I think. That lagoon or manure storage, if it's open and available to wildlife, that is a potential source of transmission to the shared ecosystem that would then help explain this local geographic spread. This is a good read. I really do think you should take a peek at it. The entire title is 2024 Highly Pathogenic Avian Influenza H5N1 Michigan Dairy Herd and Poultry Flock Summary. All right, let's jump to the other document that I've referenced and dig into that one. All right, this other document that we're talking about, put out by USDA, it is a national epidemiological brief for H5N1 genotype B313. This is all based on the epidemiologic questionnaire. The questionnaire was voluntary prior to the federal order, and now it is not voluntary since the federal order went into place. It states that epidemiologic information is currently available for 54% of confirmed premises. And this came out on June 8th. So based on this report, we have some key messages that are in the document right away. And those are, quote, the spread of H5N1 between states is linked to cattle movements versus independent wild bird introduction, with further local spread between dairy farms in some states. Disease spread between dairy cattle farms is likely multifactorial, direct and indirect transmission routes, end quote. This report is broken into sections, and the first one is the clinical picture. That is the section that we're talking about. So they're talking about clinical observations related to this disease outbreak. When we look at that, not a huge surprise what we find, but it's good, again, to have some confirmation of what we've been hearing anecdotally. So the top symptoms reported are decreased milk production, abnormal milk, decreased feed consumption, tacky dry manure, fever, and dehydration. That basically sums up the most vague clinical syndrome you could think of. So that's one of our challenges here too, is that it's all super vague. So if you have a small enough population and you have one or two animals that display this, it's really hard to say without a larger number of animals coming down with the same thing, what's going on? And it might take you a few days to figure it out, even in a large population, when you only start with a few animals that are sick, and then it ramps up very fast. But the disease presents very, very, very vague on the clinical side. So the other piece of this clinical picture is the morbidity and mortality. And what we're seeing is there's a huge range when it comes to morbidity. Morbidity is basically how many animals get clinically sick or are noticeably affected. On average, that's less than 10% of the herd, according to this document. That's what they're telling us. I don't have the range. It doesn't tell us what the range is for morbidity. Now, reportedly, when I talk to farmers, we see a massive range of decrease in milk production. The lowest I've heard is that we had an 8% drop overall in milk production. And the highest I've heard is in the 30s, 30, 31, 32%. Reduction in overall herd milk production. That's a very big range. We've been told repeatedly that most of our cows are recovering, and this document confirms that based on what they're getting from this questionnaire. When we combine mortality and culls, so culls being animals that needed to be removed because they probably didn't come back into production, they never fully recovered, combining mortality and culls, we're at 2% or less on average. So some of the other things coming out of this report, when we look at the range of impact between all the different dairies, that's what we're trying to look at. When we have reports of the days of clinical signs, there's a massive range, as low as 6 and as high as 17. And days of milk drop, we're seeing as low as 8 and as high as 15. So what we're seeing is that confirms that there is a big difference in how hard this hits between each farm. Now, what are possible reasons for that? There's so many different reasons, and that could be anything from the age of the animals on the farm and what proportion are older or younger, the proportion of animals pregnant on the farm, because we know there's a tie to pregnancy in all this, most likely. It could be related to management, lower stress animals with better cow comfort and a better plane of nutrition likely handle this disease better compared to cows that have poor cow comfort or are dealing with other things going on. High levels of lameness comes to mind, or poor nutrition. If you have this at the same time that you hit a bad spot in the bunker and you get moldy feed on top of it, that certainly can't help. So figuring that piece out might be very, very difficult. But in general, I think it's probably related to stress and what level of stress the cows in that herd are under. Now, the other piece of that that comes in is dose. This is likely dose dependent. So the more you see, the more likely you are to get sick. And the more pathogen you see, the more severe it likely is to be. So dose could play a part in this as well. The other thing I think about in this is labor. When we talk to dairymen that have experienced this, they see a noticeable difference in animals that receive supportive care. They get better faster than animals that don't. Having enough labor to get that done is a big deal, and it can cause major differences between farms depending on how labor is on each individual premise. If you're short labor already and you get hit with this, odds are you're not going to be able to provide the supportive care that's needed to get out of it as fast as possible. And it might linger, or it might be even more severe because you can't provide that supportive care that you need because you're short on help. We could go down the rabbit hole for hours trying to figure out exactly what's going on that makes it worse on one dairy compared to another. That is way down the road and not the focus right now. It's interesting. It's cool. I'd love to dive into it, but that's for later, much, much later. All right, on this mortality and morbidity overview section, we've covered most of it, but one of the things that we see on this that we've also been hearing anecdotally, this questionnaire tells us that it's not just mid to late lactation cows that are impacted. According to this questionnaire on these dairies, we have bred dairy heifers, first lactation dairy cows, second lactation dairy cows, third or higher lactation dairy cows, dry dairy cows, all impacted and noted to be impacted by the people on these affected premises. All right, let's get to the potential transmission links section. And we're looking at animal movement. So they looked at these farms and they asked them, have you received cattle within 30 days of clinical signs? And greater than 20% of the farms received cattle within 30 days of clinical signs. Now, I don't have all the data in this brief. It only gives me some of it, so I can't break it down exactly how I want to. But when we say greater than 20% of the farms received cattle within 30 days, it doesn't tell us the type or class of cattle in that statement. And it's saying greater than 20%, which means it's probably not more than 30, or else they would say greater than 30%. One in five farms received cattle within 30 days of clinical signs. So again, kind of what we talked about in the other document from Michigan, if it's not coming with cattle, and we know cattle are a risk factor, where's it coming from? The interesting questions that they asked of these farms in that same section are, did you move cattle off the farm within 30 days of onset? Which, why wouldn't you? Because you don't have clinical signs yet. You would move cattle like you normally would. And that's the majority of the farms. They moved cattle within 30 days of clinical onset. The question they asked that I found interesting was, did you move cattle off the farm after onset of clinical signs? The majority of the farms continued to move cattle off the farm after clinical signs. Now, there's many reasons that you would need to move cattle. Some systems are set up in a way that they have to move cattle in a pretty short amount of time, or it becomes a welfare issue because of lack of space and lack of labor to accommodate those cattle. It confirms what we already knew. There are cattle moving even after a premise is positive. And that's not a surprise. I mean, we have to move cattle in certain circumstances, and there's only so long you can hold cattle in certain systems. Moving with some traceability gives us the opportunity to learn more about whether or not those animals are a risk. If we move without any traceability, there's no way to capture that data to know if those movements of non-lactating animals are a problem or not. Okay, let's move on to other species present on dairy farms. Greater than 80% of the farms have cats present, and greater than 50% of the farms with cats observed sick or dead cats. We've talked about cats a lot. Cats are a player in this. They're a risk factor. Both brains and urine have tested positive. We definitely need to dig into what is going on with cats. The other piece of this is that not all cats on dairy farms are barn cats. They can, at times, go in the house, or there are cats that stay in the house, but could potentially be exposed through the people bringing things inside from the farm. I do some small animal relief work, and I get to talk to clients, and I see cats in the clinic. And one of my favorite questions is to ask, where did you get this cat? Because the amount of times that I hear, oh, I rescued it, or I picked it up from a farm, there's a lot of barn cats that become not barn cats anymore and join families in the cities. This might be a situation where we have to pull in our small animal colleagues on the veterinary side and make sure that they know to watch for this. Neurologic signs in cats, we gotta be thinking about this. All right, moving on. Greater than 20% of farms have chickens or poultry present. Nearly all farms with poultry observe sick or dead poultry. Greater than 20% of farms having poultry. I don't know if that's surprising or not. It strikes me as quite large of a number, and that might be a different thing compared to Michigan and Minnesota. But if I think about it hard, there's a lot of dairies that have chickens or other poultry around. So the takeaway from this section, according to the document, is other species present on farm can become infected and potentially serve as a fomite or indicate disease status on farm. So they're acknowledging that other species may be bringing this to other farms after they become infected and moving it in a local area. They're also saying that some of these species might be kind of a canary in the coal mine situation. If you see dead cats or sick cats, or you see dead poultry, or you see both, odds are you should be looking very closely at your cattle herd if you haven't noticed something already. All right, next section is wild birds. All farms observe some type of wild birds near cattle. Not a surprise. I mean, how are you going to keep wild birds out of the barn? 29% of farms observed sick or dead wild birds within 30 days prior to onset of clinical signs. Now, again, I don't have all the data in this document, but the statement from them is, quote, no genomic or epidemiologic evidence that wild birds are spreading H5N1 to cattle, but cannot be ruled out, end quote. I'd love to hear more explanation of that statement, but it implies that the birds are dying because they're getting sick from the cows, not the other way around. Moving on to shared transportation vehicles. Greater than 50% of farms use trucks and trailers that are shared with other farms to transport livestock within 30 days prior to onset of clinical signs. That's very similar to the Michigan piece. There's a lot of shared transportation. Greater than 50% of farms that use shared vehicles do not clean vehicles prior to use. That, again, not a surprise after reading the Michigan document. There's not very many farms that are cleaning shared vehicles prior to use. That's a pretty low-hanging fruit. When we talk about manure and handling equipment for manure, the big takeaway and the big statement from them in this document is greater than 25% of farms use the same equipment to handle manure and animal feed. And that number is actually at 28% of the farms in this study use the same equipment to handle manure and animal feed. Of the farms that use the same equipment to handle manure and feed, 75% of them do not clean between use. So again, I don't have all the information in this document for how they're making all these statements, but the takeaway is, quote, risk from manure appears low based on individual cow manure samples, but more research is needed. Contaminated equipment is a recognized risk for disease transmission, end quote. So part of that is really straightforward. You probably shouldn't use the same equipment to handle manure as you use to handle feed. And if you are going to, you should clean it in between use. Very low hanging fruit. Totally agree. Now, what I don't agree with this statement is the use of the word manure. They say the risk from manure appears low based on individual cow manure samples. I think that's a little misleading. An individual cow sample is a fecal sample. It's not manure. Manure encompasses a lot more than just feces. If you think about what's incorporated into manure, you can have all sorts of materials in manure that you're going to then spread on the field. So when we talk about manure storage, you can have feces, you can have urine, water, you can have bedding, you can have milk potentially in there. There's all sorts of materials that are in manure. So to say that the risk from manure is low is not something we can say yet, because we don't have any data that we can say whether or not it's in manure. So I don't like the use of the word manure in this sense. I wish they would have just said feces, because manure is different, especially when we're talking about in the context of what we saw in the last document, where what people do with waste milk. Waste milk in the majority of those farms was dumped in lagoons in Michigan. That is manure. Lagoons are manure storage, not feces storage. They're manure storage. And we're dumping waste milk in that lagoon. Manure encompasses so many more things. So I see how it could have been used as a term, because there's big portions of the country and many dairies that I visited where, for whatever reason, people just don't want to say the word feces. They don't want to say the word poop. They're more than willing to say S-H-I-T, no problem. But they prefer to say manure when referring to cow feces. But in the context of this document, I feel it's just a little misleading, and we should have just said feces, because I have no idea what the risk of manure is, and I don't think anyone has the data to tell us whether it's a risk or not. But if it has waste milk in it, odds are it is a risk factor. All right, last section, potential transmission links, people, shared personnel. Greater than 20% of dairies' employees visit other dairies within 30 days of onset of clinical signs. Greater than 20% of dairies' employees own livestock or poultry at their personal residence. Greater than 30% of dairies' employees work at another farm with livestock. Most of these employees work on another dairy. And 20% of dairies' employees have family members who work at another farm with livestock. So just like in the Michigan document, shared personnel is a potential risk factor, and we need to be maybe asking these questions of our employees. We got to be careful about how we do it, because remember, these people are trying to make a living, just like all of us, and they're making it work by having multiple jobs. So is there a good fix or solution in this situation? I don't know, but it might be more paying attention to, if you're going to do that, if you're going to have employees that are shared between premises, being more conscious about what they're bringing back and forth between premises. Dedicated clothing and boots with a shower in between might be a great idea if they're not doing that already. Vehicles traveling between the two premises, also something to pay attention to. Those people have to get between those premises in some way. And then at home, we've talked about this a little bit, but you know, you want to treat your home like a farm too. If you've got animals there, it's a farm. So make sure that you have dedicated clothing for at home as well. And if you can, keep it out of the house. You know, that's not always possible, but if you are going to bring clothing or anything else in from your home farm into your house, maybe get it washed right away. Some of that can get really complicated really fast. It's a lot of moving parts. It's a lot of extra clothing and extra boots and extra steps when you're already tired from a really long day. So I totally get that it is an incredibly easy thing to say and a much harder thing to do. But I think if you are open with communication with employees and you foster that culture on your farm of openness about those things, you can find ways to work through it that are practical and they don't add too much hindrance to everyone's day. But the first step is knowing about it and having that openness to talk about it in a way that doesn't alienate your staff or your employees. All right, we made it to the end of the documents, and I hope that that is helpful. I hope I didn't go on too many rambling tangents, but if you have comments, questions, scathing rebuttals, they go to themoosroom@umn.edu. You can always call me, 612-624-3610. Hang in there, everybody. My offer still stands to veterinarians, producers, anybody who's dealing with this, having a hard time. Call me. Get in contact with me. We'll talk about it. We can hopefully figure out some things that work for you. More than happy to do that. Take care, everybody. Catch you next episode.